Let me confess something at this stage of the program, and that is I don't do crosswords. I never have. If I need to sort of fill in some time, I'm an obsessive player of patience, or otherwise known as solitaire, but I'm very well aware that many of you, dear listeners, turn to crosswords, particularly in this time of isolation. Well, you'd be fascinated to learn that these, humble puzzles have a history of bringing solace in times of crisis. In fact, it was only after the Japanese military strike against the US naval base at Pearl Harbor that the New York Times started including a crossword for its readers, and was the last major metropolitan newspaper in America to do so, which is surprising given the romance that's blossomed since between the two. It's just one of many fascinating facts that you'll learn about the crossword if you read Adrienne Raffel's new book, Thinking Inside the Box, Adventures with Crosswords and the Puzzling People Who Can't Live Without Them. And we've got her on the line now from Vermont to tell us more about your favourite little puzzle. Adrienne, welcome to our Little Wireless program.
Thank you so much for having me.
The first word cross puzzle was invented out of desperation by Arthur Wynne. Tell me about writer's block.
So it's something that we all face, right? And so Arthur Wynne was an editor at the New York World newspaper, and he was the editor in charge of putting together their fun supplement, the puzzles and games and, all the good stuff in the paper, right? So they wanted a specially big section for Christmas in 1913, and Arthur Wynne was like, well, I've run out of all my usual puzzles, and I have this huge section of the paper to fill. And so luckily technology had gotten better at sort of printing blank grids at the time, and he thought, oh, a blank grid, that's great. That'll fill a huge swath of my paper, and then what can I do? Oh, I've seen word searchy games. I can put clues to help people fill in this blank grid if I make it kind of a word puzzle. And he called it Fun's Word Cross Puzzle. And so with a typographical error a few weeks later that switched it to crossword, the crossword puzzle was born.
I don't want to take anything away from Wynne, but as you point out, there were sort of word puzzles of similar nature before that. They were, for example, found in children's papers in England.
Exactly. And that's where Wynne had gotten the idea from. There were a bunch of and word search puzzles and word puzzles are as old as, language. There's magic word squares inscribed in the ruins of Pompeii. There were medieval monasteries with sort of riddles and stuff going around. There's lots of word games, of course. The Bible has word games in it. But what Wynne did
I'm sorry. Yeah. run that past me. Where are the crosswords? There's a lot of crosswords, but where's the crossword puzzle in the Bible, for heaven's sake?
I know. I've been looking for it too. There are some like anagrams and different kinds of word puzzle things going on in the Bible and numerology, but not a crossword puzzle that I think the scholars have discovered yet. Maybe there's some Dead Sea Scrolls.
I can suddenly envisage a copy of the Bible which says, "In the beginning there was the crossword." But let's move on from that. the crossword really got its big break when it made the leap from newspapers to books, and I was astonished to learn that the original crossword collection was actually published by Simon & Schuster. In fact, it was their first book.
And what I love about this is that Simon and Schuster, they thought it was going to be a big flop. They were scared. And so they didn't want to put it out under their names. So instead of starting off their publishing, you know, their dignified Simon and Schuster publishing house with the crossword puzzle collection, they actually started it off with under Plaza Publishing. They used this sort of fake name that they derived from their phone number, which in the United States, their phone number had a word and it was Plaza something something, and they were like, okay, Plaza Publishing, if our crossword book fails, nobody will know it's us, we'll just sneak under the radar. Turned out to be the Simon & Schuster's, I think, like, biggest seller of all time. In all things told, they've had a crossword collection in their house since 1924. That first one sold 135,000 copies in the first edition alone.
Heavens above. So the height of the crossword craze, you date as to the in the 1920s.
That was the first, big crossword craze. There were crossword dances, crossword songs, millions of people just doing the crossword on their commute, and anywhere they could lay their hands on this book. There was a run on dictionaries and encyclopedias and libraries wrote really snippy notes to their patrons saying, you know what, we have to limit the use of dictionaries because everybody's trying to grab them to look up these crossword answers. Go read a book instead.
When does the cryptic crossword kick in, Adrian?
Yeah, the cryptic starts around 1925. What happened was in England, people were looking over to this American craze and saying, well, that's... they were sort of poo-pooing it for a little bit, and then they got their hands on some of these puzzles and they got addicted. But then the cryptic started with... Edwin Powys Mathis, who this guy who named himself Torquemada, that was his crossword pseudonym, and he thought crosswords were way too easy, and so he said, you know what, these can be more fun, these can be more devilish, I'm going to make these more intricate, and so he devised this new way of cluing that's cryptic cluing, that's got, you know, the all of these different layers of wordplay and different kinds of hints. If it says the word's supposed to, you know, be scrambled or backwards, you should do that with it. So he, this constructor who went by Torquemada, named himself after the Spanish torturer because he wanted to torture people a little better.
I was alerting people to your part in our program at the beginning of the show, and I introduced the word cruciverbalist, which I absolutely love. Who coined that, do you know?
I wish I knew, but it's really, in the research, I discovered that word existed. And cruciverbalist, cruciverbalism. It's so good. It just, you know, it's just from Latin for crux, cross, and then verbum, word. So, but I don't know who coined it first, but whoever it is, hats off.
And hats off to Stephen Sondheim, who loves, of course, words, loves playing with them. And he tried to introduce that British-style cryptic crossword to the US, but it didn't quite take off at the time.
He did. He, and hats off to Sondheim. He's just so extraordinary. And he, in the 1960s, he wrote several cryptic crosswords for New York Magazine, a magazine in the States. And he kind of introduced them by saying, all the American puzzles you've been doing are, you know, they're easy, they're garbage, not garbage, but like you could be doing better, and here's puzzles for you. And I have to say, they are wonderful puzzles. They are so hard, and I admire them so much. I can see how maybe, you know, they might take about 4 cups of coffee and 4 hours to do in the morning.
Adrian, I've confessed to being... I'm not into them. I've never understood them, and I just sort of changed the subject. But do you do them yourself?
Well, so that's kind of a beautiful thing. I love words and word games, and like I love talking to people about puzzles. I've gotten into constructing them, but like, and I've gotten better, but honestly I am kind of average at crossword puzzles myself, and I went into this book being pretty average at them. You know, I know how to do them, but I am not at all one of these experts. And I think that's what I really actually love about the crossword, is that it's there for you at all skill levels, all kinds of engagement with it, whether, you know, you think you're just frustrated and want to put it aside, or whether you're one of these like solvers who can get the world's hardest puzzles in, you know, 8 minutes. The crossword is always, there's always a kind of crossword out there for you. So I'd encourage you, you know, try again, just try a little mini crossword. Why not?
I, by curious example of synchronicity, I spent much of the day writing about Bletchley Park and about Alan Turing, completely different area. I wasn't concerned with crosswords, but of course Bletchley Park and the crossword have a tangled history. Would you explain that to me?
This is something I love, that in World War II, they, in England, when they were looking for people, the Brit, and by they, I mean British intelligence officials, were looking for more people to be at Bletchley Park and being code breakers and solving the Enigma code. What they did was they ran this crossword contest in, I think it was the Telegraph newspaper, and they said, you know what, we're going to run a contest, we're going to get the best crossword solvers, and then we're going to say, you know, because the best crossword solvers in Britain, I bet, would be the best code breakers in Britain. That's probably how we're going to find new people to help us crack these codes. And so they got, yeah, they ran this crossword contest very innocuously. Just, oh, you know, if you happen to think you're good at crosswords, try this thing. And then the top solvers, they had intelligence officials coming to the door saying, you know, congratulations, you are now recruited to come to Bletchley Park.
I'm not sure whether you cover it, but I've got a vague memory that crosswords were also used in the Second World War to send coded information to agents.
Well, there was a crossword kind of scandal in the Second World War, as well as, you know, crosswords kind of being a hero for finding code breakers. There was this scandal where they agents discovered that around the months leading up to D-Day, there were all these code words appearing in the puzzle, words like Jupiter, Neptune, and Overlord, and Mulberry, and words they were using for their operations. And there were just a few too many of these weird words all appearing at once. And so then they all realized they were all appearing in puzzles by the same guy, the school teacher. So they went to the school teacher's house, and he was just completely bewildered. He's like, I don't know what you mean. And it turned out his school was next to an army base. He'd been having students help him fill in the puzzle, and the students had been overhearing these code words, and they brought in these cool code words. And the poor school teacher had no idea that he was accidentally being a traitor or a possible traitor. But yeah, so like there were code words appearing in the puzzle kind of by accident, we think.
We mentioned the sort of love-hate relationship between the New York Times and the crossword. Tell me a bit more about that.
This is also a World War II thing. So in the 20s and 30s, when the crossword was becoming really popular in America and Britain, the New York Times, you know, it just kind of remained aloof from it. It said, well, we don't need to pander to our readers. We don't need to grab them with games. They were for a while, like the only major metropolitan daily in America not to run a crossword. Then, when Pearl Harbor hit, about 11 days after Pearl Harbor, an editor at the Times sent a memo to the publisher and said, you know what? We're entering dark days. We're entering blackout days, literally. Like, we are, our headlines are terrible. We need a crossword. And so, yeah.
I'm delighted by some of the crossword players you have discovered. Nabokov, for example, composed butterfly-shaped crosswords in letters to his wife. T.S. Eliot did the crossword every day on the on a big red London omnibus. And you say that amongst the cognoscenti these days in the U.S., you've got John Stewart, Bill Clinton, Yo-Yo Ma, Martha Stewart. Even Nancy Pelosi finds time when she's not trying to have Trump impeached.
Yes, yeah. Nancy Pelosi is a really big crossword fan. I know some constructors who have gotten sort of emails or fan letters from Nancy Pelosi, which I find really wonderful.
And there's one person in America who I'm absolutely certain wouldn't do crosswords, and that's the incumbent president.
Oh, I don't think he would. I mean, I think we agree on this. I don't know if he would be have the capacity to even know what a crossword is.
I understand that you went on a cruise on the Queen Mary II, which was crossword related.
I did. That was a wild experience. The New York Times ran a journeys crossword cruise on a crossword crossing, I should say, because it was one way, and you could be a part of this group of people who spent a week aboard the Queen Mary II, going from America to London, thinking about crosswords, constructing crosswords, listening to lectures about crosswords, doing crosswords every day. It was so wild and fun and a crazy sort of experience of just being with all of these people who, you know, loved crosswords enough to devote 7 days to doing nothing but crosswords.
Heavens above. I think I'm glad I missed that. I missed that trip. In this time of isolation, business must be booming. Are there online crosswords? Is this a huge phenomenon now?
It is, and it's become a huge phenomenon in the past decade or so. And you're right, business is booming for the crossword. The crossword is the perfect, you know, the business was booming before this current time of social distancing, I should say. But now, especially, it's kind of the perfect activity to be doing both alone and with other people at the same time. So there are lots of great both independent crosswords online and crosswords, of course, through newspapers and magazines that you can access online on your phone, you know, and still you can order safely in print.
I know you talk about people who try to make a living writing crosswords, you know, conceiving them, but it was never very lucrative, was it?
It's mostly just a freelance model. And, you know, there are a lot of major publications. The New York Times is paying more for each crossword, and other ones are, but as well. And there's, you know, more money to be made in crosswords, but really it is, you know, it's still a very kind of freelance model, and the hourly wage, don't try to calculate that out.
I promise I won't. I'm wondering whether there's now some sort of algorithm which can do crosswords.
So that's also a beautiful thing about crosswords. There are some programs that can do them, and one that a programmer named Matt Ginsburg created, calls it Dr. Phil, and he brings it to a crossword tournament. But the best crossword solver on the best AI crossword solver, the best computer at it, still can't beat the best humans. Humans, you know, computers might have poker and Go and backgammon and chess and a bunch of other games, but humans to this point still have crosswords.
Now, we've only got a moment left, but I'd like to spend it with you singing the praises of Will Shortz.
Oh, absolutely. Will Shortz is so the New York Times crossword editor and NPR's puzzle master in America. He's kind of the emperor of the crossword world in America, at least I'd say. And he really, when he came to the New York Times in 1993, he really opened up the kinds of clues that the New York Times was putting in, the kinds of puzzles. The Times puzzle had become kind of a stuffy old white boys club, and then Will Shortz really made a push to make sure that it had much more diversity. It was much more inclusive, that everybody could find themselves both in the puzzle and constructing the puzzle. So he was the one who really, and now there's even more, you know, there's so much more diversity of puzzles beyond the New York Times. It's so great. But he was the one I would credit to really starting that push.
Adrian, thank you very much. You've been a tonic to all of us. Adrian Raphael, writer and Princeton University lecturer. Her book is called Thinking Inside the Box, Adventures with Crosswords and the Puzzling People Who Can't Live Without Them. It's published in Australia by Hachette.